Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hello and welcome to the 2021 edition of Still Watching. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
We are kicking off this new year with a new show. We are going to geekier realms than we've ever gone before. We are covering WandaVision, the new Disney Plus show that picks up two characters from the MCU and plunks them in sort of a sitcom TV wonderland. We picked this show for a couple reasons, but one of the reasons why is I thought that there was real potential for us to talk about it as a TV show and then also talk about it in sort of a geekier comic book kind of way. So basically, not to use too much of like a cutesy Avengers Assemble, logic, but we have assembled here for you on this podcast a crack team.
We're doing a podcast about a TV show about TV shows.
Amazing.
We're going pretty deep. Yeah.
What could be better? So how the structure is going to be a little different from still watching episodes in the past. Basically, Richard and I are going to talk for the first half of the episode about the episode, Richard's impressions. Richard has not done like the deep dive comic book research, nor does anyone have to, I think, in order to enjoy this show. And so we're just going to talk about the show as a show. If Richard has some questions and I feel like I can answer them for him, that's great. If not, whatever. In the middle of the show, there will be an interview with someone. This week, we have none other than Marvel Studios CEO Kevin Feige. So, I'm dusting off my shoulders for that interview yet. So, yeah, Kevin Feige will be talking to us, and we'll have members of the cast and the directors and like all sorts of stuff later down the road. And then in the final segment of every episode covering WandaVision, our colleague Anthony Bresnikan, Richard will be gone, and our colleague Anthony Bresnikan will join me, and we will talk really nerdy stuff about the show. So I think there's something, genuinely think there's something for everyone. I'm pretty excited about this.
And when you said Richard's impressions, you meant my impression of Catherine Hahn, right? That's what you meant?
I would like to hear it right now.
Ralph? I don't know. I can't.
Really
can't
good.
Do it. Yeah.
I like it. For the record, this week we are just going to be talking about episodes 1 and 2 because they both aired Friday the 15th. So you haven't seen episodes 1 and 2 of WandaVision, you might want to go watch them now. This is a 9-episode season. Show's created by Jack Schaefer, which sounds like a dude's name, but it is a lady. And each episode is directed by Matt Shakman. So you might be familiar with his name because he directed some Game of Thrones, but he also directed like 40-something episodes of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. And he was a sitcom kid star himself. He was on Just the 10 of Us, which is a show that I watched as a kid. So Matt is bringing all sorts of angles to the table. And if you've watched the first two episodes of the show, you might have already noticed this, but, you know, just to break down kind of the structure of WandaVision, at least for a time, and we're not sure for how long, each episode of WandaVision is going to coordinate with a decade of television. Usually there's like a pretty close one-to-one show analog in these first two episodes. The first episode is a Dick Van Dyke show sort of homage, and the second episode is a Bewitched scenario, and it's supposed to take us, like, even though technically Dick Van Dyke show aired in the 60s, it's supposed to take us 50s and 60s, and then next week will be the 70s and then the 80s, etc. But I imagine they're going to run out before we get to the end of 9, and that I think is when the show is maybe going to get a bit more Marvel-y. One last thing before I kick it over to Richard, because I have some questions for Richard. I just want to remind you all, if you're longtime listeners of the show, or if you're just joining us, you can be a part of the conversation by emailing us at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. Any questions, be they basic or extremely detailed, we would love to hear them. So, let's go. And like, I'm really, really excited about this because this is a theory show, and I love a Richard Lawson theory. So,
oh no,
Richard, no pressure.
Yeah,
Richard, like, what do you know about like Wanda and Vision and the MCU going into the show? Like, what are you aware of?
Well, I know what I've seen in the movies. I have seen all of the Marvel movies. Mm-hmm. But very few more than once, though. I know that she's from a made-up country. Her brother died, played by Aaron Taylor-Johnson in the Avengers sequel. And somewhere also in that movie, Vision was born. He's played by Paul Bettany. He used to be the voice of Jarvis, the Tony Stark AI, right?
Crushing it.
And then something, he got created because I don't remember. And then he died in either Endgame or the first one.
Infinity War. Yeah.
Infinity War.
Yeah.
And that's where we last left both characters, essentially, right? With him dead, her mourning, and seemingly to come into a fuller form of her power. But as Marvel has done in the past, like, and is going to do with the upcoming Black Widow, which Jack Schaefer wrote, this could be sandwiched in somewhere in that timeline. It's not necessarily mm-hmm. after everything, right?
It could, yeah.
Yeah, so we don't really know. But what's intriguing about the show, other than the obvious homages to sitcoms of old, and seeing, you know, Marvel characters kind of within that environment, is that it's my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, Joanna, that this particular conceit, this story, is not actually based on comic book, one comic book narrative, right? Like, obviously, like, they're pulling things from different, you know, iterations of these characters' stories, but, like, this is new for television, correct?
Yeah, I mean, you and I were talking about this a little off air earlier today. The idea of Wanda and Vision being skipping through decades of television, that's a completely original conceit.
Cool.
And I think it's born out of, Kevin Feige has said, like, he watched a lot of Nick at Night as a kid. And so, if you too watch Nick at Night as a kid, you may also want to someday do something with your love of the Dick Van Dyke Show. So it came from that. But there's a comic book called The Vision that came out in like 2016, 2015, I think, written by Tom King, which is about Vision creating a like little perfect suburban family of other little androids, and they move to the suburbs. So this that idea of like Vision and a perfect little family in the suburbs, I think was inspired by that book. And then some of this other stuff that's going on with Wanda, which we will learn more and more about as it unfolds, is from another pretty famous comic storyline that I don't even want to name, you know, in case it gives away the game. But yeah, so I think he's pulling from a couple things and then packaging it. And as far as I can tell, this was his idea, packaging it in this interesting sort of exploration of the American family sitcom.
Yeah, and it's also, I mean, if people are interested, I mean, and you certainly would know about this more than I do, Joanna, but like it's interesting in terms of where Marvel Entertainment as a company is in their, you know, being owned by Disney and Disney Plus, and that this is the first Disney Plus Marvel show. And it wasn't intended to be, but it is now, and is thus far a pretty big departure from your standard Marvel movies kind of story. And I think that's interesting just as a viewer, because we've seen a lot of Marvel movies and it's fun to see something different from this company, but also as a kind of first flexing of a kind of newer muscle to be like, this world that we've built, this cinematic universe, like, we can kind of tweak it in so many different ways, you know, and in the way that the comic books have, you know, for the better part of a century. And you know, a kind of comedy sci-fi thing or whatever this is. You know, I don't think that necessarily means we're going to get like a straight up, you know, Black Widow romantic comedy or a musical or whatever. But right. but I think, you know, however we feel, and I know most of us have like kind of mixed feelings about the sort of Marvel, you know, hegemony, I don't know. But like, look, it's here. We're not going to get rid of it. It is at the very least interesting to see what they do now that they can really do whatever they want, really, you know, and as a first, based on these first two episodes, like as a kind of first example of that, like, it's interesting. And it's also interesting that as someone who thought maybe he was getting a little tired of the movies, even though I really liked Endgame, that like, I actually care, you know, I'm like into it. And I'm happy to see at least these performers again. I don't really know the characters well enough, but I guess maybe that's part of the point of this show.
Well, yeah, I think they, you know, and they've said as much that they've been like pretty not marginalized, but, you know, like on the margins of a bigger story characters. And so this is a chance, you know, like basically Marvel looks in its stable and sees that it has like, you know, two glossy ponies in the shape of Elizabeth Olsen and Paul Bettany. And they're like, why don't we let these people take the spotlight? And I do think it's interesting, you know, like, you know, I like Marvel a lot. I understand some of the criticism of it feeling samey after a while. I think cinematically they've proved that they're willing to go in different directions with like Guardians of the Galaxy or, you know, Doctor Strange. You know, there are some like, there are some different flavors, but like sometimes it does feel like French vanilla versus Madagascar vanilla versus like whatever, you know, whatever kind of vanilla. And then this feels like strawberry. I don't know why I'm like talking about Neapolitan ice cream, but like this does feel to me very different. I'm so glad, you know, it was not the plan. The plan was to do Falcon and the Winter Soldier as the first one. And I think Falcon and the Winter Soldier, from what I know of it, would have been like a much drier sort of expected Captain America, Iron Man-esque, militarized kind of show.
Action-adventure kind of thing.
Action-adventure. And this is a different genre. And I think, you know, stuff like the Loki show looks like it might be sort of like a Doctor Who-y kind of thing. So I do think that, like, Kevin Feige having, like, you know, however you feel about Marvel, Kevin Feige having conquered Hollywood in a pretty short time, you know, making this massive crossover to film conclusion to this decade of entertainment, making the most, you know, the most profitable film in the world and blah, blah, blah. It feels a little bit like he wept for he had no more worlds to conquer. And then he was like, okay, what about TV? Didn't quite go that way. I think Disney was sort of like, we would like to see this happen. And, you know, some maybe, I don't know if it's interesting for people to know this, but behind the scenes stuff is, yes, there was Marvel stuff on television before. There was like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Agent Carter. There was the whole Netflix era with Daredevil and Jessica Jones, stuff like that. And some of that stuff was good. Some of this stuff was not so good. But all that stuff was run by an executive named Jeff Loeb. Jeff Loeb is not in, like, that's Marvel TV versus Marvel Studios. This is Marvel Studios. This is Kevin Feige of Marvel Studios taking his first crack at television. And like you, Richard, I'm really excited that this is the project that they're launching. So.
And there is a tradition of this. I mean, I'm gonna frame this in terms I really know intimately. Mm-hmm. You obviously have your flagship Archie comic that comes out every month, and you have Betty and Veronica. Maybe in the, you know, certain days you'd have a Pals and Gals or whatever. But sometimes there would be these shorter run, like Ethel, you know, installments, yeah. or yeah. a Jughead or whatever. And this kind of feels like that. It's not meant to be, I don't think, a 10 season TV series. It's just like a kind of little side narrative that does something different, changes a tone. So it's not like, it's interesting to see Marvel Studios and the Kevin Feige of it all, like, do something for the first time for themselves, but like in the broader scope of superhero comics or really any kind of comics, this is actually fairly standard practice. So it's interesting to see it kind of manifested in this way, which it hasn't really before. I guess you could call some of the movies sort of more spin-offy, ancillary, but really all of those kind of the leads of all those big movies are really central to the larger kind of Avengers narrative. And not that Wanda and Vision aren't, but like, yeah. Anyway, this feels like your special run of Ethel Muggs.
No, I hear exactly what you're saying. And I think, you know, you'll hear in the Kevin Feige interview, we did talk about this, about like how the movies were comic book storytelling and how the TV might be even more comic book storytelling in terms of like thinking of seasons as runs and episodes as issues or something like that. and I think what's also interesting is that Marvel Studios and Disney Plus, they're really, it feels like they're really committed. What has happened to television recently is that with the advent of streaming, and our fractured attention span, increasingly you'll see that television no longer has to be like every season is, certainly not every season is 22 episodes. Not even every season has to be 10 episodes. Not every episode has to be 30 minutes. Not every episode has to be an hour. It's like, we're going to tell exactly how much story we have. So for WandaVision, I would guess this is a one and done season, even if it's fantastic, just because of the way that it's probably going to lead into some movie storytelling that's upcoming. But there's already rumors that the Loki show has been greenlit for a second season. So it's just sort of like, it's not going to be beholden to anything other than how much story do we have to tell about this character? Let's tell it in 9 episodes that are 22-ish minutes long, maybe. Or some of the episodes are longer, or some of the seasons are shorter. And that's, the freedom of that. You know, you might only have 6 issues of Ethel worth telling. So there you go. You know,
well, I don't know. That's not very fair to Ethel. But I think, you know, kind of away from the Marvel of it all, but closer to sort of like TV discourse and culture. I think about a show like Homecoming, especially, you know, both seasons, but like the first season was so great. I like the second season, but that's a show that did, you know, moody, very stylish, sci-fi comedy paranoia thriller in a half an hour installment, you know, and the thinking before them was like that kind of show's an hour and then a comedy's, you know, so I like that there's more malleability with format and length and all that, and I think that the format for this works really well, because obviously it's mimicking a sitcom episode length, but I like the kind of short burst, all right, onto the next kind of momentum of the show. I was a little nervous before I learned that those episodes were as short as they are, that it was going to be kind of a lot, you know, to kind of take in any given sitting. But I think it's so far like pretty efficient and is representative of, yeah, just sort of more, I don't know, progressive thinking about what TV can be.
Right. And the way that each episode, at least, you know, at the beginning, is a sitcom plot that wraps, you know, there's stuff happening around the fringes, and we'll talk about that a little bit. But there's each episode that we've seen so far, you and I have seen three episodes, but we're only talking about two, has like a sitcom plot, a classic sitcom plot that's wrapped up in 20 something minutes. And that really makes this feel like actual television versus a 6-hour movie, which is like what so many, you know, TV shows like to call themselves these days. A lot of the Netflix stuff, because it was bingey, you know, I could not pick out a single episode of even my favorite of the Marvel Netflix seasons, which is Daredevil season one. Like I couldn't tell you. But for this, you can just be like, oh yeah, the Dick Van Dyke episode. Yeah. The Bewitched episode. Like, you know, that these are distinctive chapters, and that's nice to see, because, you know, it feels like television storytelling of this kind of is going away a little bit. And I like to see Kevin Feige doing a sort of a stubborn retro version of it. I think it's great. So, yeah. All right. So what do you think is going on in these first two episodes that you've seen, Richard?
Well, I think it's interesting that in the second episode with Emma Caulfield from Buffy.
Yeah.
That was a fun surprise. She played Anya on Buffy. And I was like, is that Kathleen Robertson from 90210? And then I was like, oh, no, it's another woman from that era who I loved on TV. But in that episode, when, you know, they're in her, Emma Caulfield's character's backyard, and the thing with the breaking of the water glass and everything, the radio is addressing Wanda. And is saying, like, who did this to you? So that leads me to believe that, like, maybe Vision still is dead, you know, and she is trapped in some kind of simulation or experiment or something. And she actually is sort of who the series is about more than it's about Vision, which would then, I guess, make more sense with the sort of continuity of the movies.
Yeah, I mean, I really think that's kind of a safe assessment of what's going on. And I think especially stuff we see, like in episode one, when, you know, the boss and his wife come over for dinner, played by Fred Melamed and the great Deborah Jo Rupp of, you know, That 70s Show fame, come over for dinner, and Fred Melamed is choking, and Deborah Jo Rupp, who, you know, Mrs. Hart has, it's like this really creepy moment where she's like, stop it, stop it. And she's seemingly addressing Wanda. And then Wanda, once again, my interpretation is that Wanda kind of like releases Vision. She says, go help him. And Vision gets up and helps him. And there's also another, you know, there's other things that happen that just really make me feel like, to a certain degree, Wanda has some agency, though it's unclear how conscious she is of the agency that she has in this scenario. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And it's, you know, it's a popular kind of genre or subgenre for a reason, but I love the sort of like people realizing they're actually caught in something that's not real. You know, obviously The Matrix is a pretty big example, but I think there's actually less of that dawning awareness within the actual Matrix of The Matrix. He gets kind of taken out of it and then explain to him, but watching people kind of in game, let's call it, like, is really fun. Even in a movie like Serenity, the crazy Matthew McConaughey Anne Hathaway movie that I won't spoil unless in case you haven't seen it, though I guess I did kind of just spoil that that's a simulation, but what kind of simulation? You know, and I just think there's so much cool potential that I think this show seizes on for just paranoid, creepy, just kind of nipping at the edges of something. And then to have that juxtaposed with all the brightness, the sort of really like, you know, high intensity cheer of sitcoms of, you know, the middle of the last century. Like, it's a really good offset. I mean, of course it reminds you of the Truman Show or Pleasantville. So this show has its obvious, beyond the Dick Van Dyke Show and Bewitched and stuff, it has other influences that are, you know, coming to bear on the series. But I think it's the tone, especially that I'm glad you mentioned the Deborah Jo Rupp thing, because that is such a good creepy like what's like glitch in the Matrix kind of moment.
Yeah, and there's a similar glitch in episode two beyond the scene with Emma Caulfield where she cuts her hand and the blood is red. You know, that's what gives you that nice Pleasantville vibe, is like some things are in color and you're like, what's happening? There's a little toy helicopter. Why is that in color? There's the scene where like this beekeeper comes out of the sewer. Mm. And Vision sort of starts asking questions, and Wanda kind of resets. It seems to me she kind of resets the scene. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, she says no, or like, something. Yeah. I guess I hadn't really thought about that she's much more conscious of the simulation than.
But I'm not sure how conscious.
Yeah. But that beekeeper scene is creepy, and it also kind of brought to mind like something like Homecoming, which really had all these kind of striking, very strange visuals. Actually there's a big bird in both of those shows. That's funny. I guess the big bird's in episode 3. Sorry guys, spoiler. I think also Elizabeth Olsen is an interesting performer to be in this kind of thing, because I think of her as more of a serious actress, not so much as a comedian. I think she's done some lighter stuff, but this is a good kind of, I think, a challenge for her kind of more comic side that I think she rises to. But then also taps into something a little darker, like where she first, I think, kind of rose to prominence in the Sean Durkin film Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene, which is about a woman who has escaped seemingly a cult, and goes to live with her sister, played by Sarah Paulson, but is very tight-lipped about what happened to her and how she got out, but is definitely scared that something is coming for her, you know? And it's a really unsettling, like kind of mood piece of a movie. And she's so good in it. And I think she brings some of that kind of almost like double awareness into this. Like she's trying to like be present, but also there's this other consciousness in her that's like scared, basically, or not, if not scared, at least alarmed about something. So I think it's really fun to be able to watch an actor playing a character they've now played in how many movies, but getting to do something very different with it.
I mean, similarly, Paul Bettany, like he gets to do, he's so funny in the show, I think. And, as Vision, he had some moments of comedy as Vision in the films, but mostly, you know, he's a kind of a stiff android. And this is an excuse for him to like go full like Dick Van Dyke slapstick comedy, which I think he does really, really well. And I'd love to see him do more of in the future. You mentioned Pleasantville, Truman Show. When Emma Caulfield showed up with her like super crisp blonde hair, I thought of Stepford Wives.
Oh,
like,
fully,
there's like a lot of fun stuff going on. The creators of the show have mentioned the Twilight Zone as sort of an inspiration. For me, it also has like a Twin Peaksy, David Lynchian Blue Velvet vibe to me. That sort of like 50s suburbia, but what's the menace that's lurking in your hedges? You know what I mean? What's going on really around you? And that stop it scene from the first episode just really gives me those Lynchian heebie-jeebies, you know?
Yeah, totally. I think that I did file a review of the show that will be up when this airs, but I talked about the good and I talked about stuff I have a little bit of concern about. And I think that one of those things, the major thing, is I like that sense of creeping menace. Like that's a really effectively, registered thing in the show. But I also wonder how long they can sustain that without just being like, okay, here's what's going on, you know, because I think that, you know, having it be shifting into new decades and new sort of styles of television, I think that'll help keep things fresh. But at a certain point, we're going to get the joke, you know, of like, okay, now they're in, you know, they're doing the show thing. So I wonder, I'll be really curious to see how the show plots itself in that way. Like how soon are we really going to have a much bigger picture of what's happening? It's my understanding that there's already at least one character who's shown up who has a bigger relevance to the Marvel world. I sort of chose not to look into that because I don't want to be spoiled, but,
sure.
But yeah, I'm very, very curious to see how much this ties into like the world of the movies and when it does, if it does at all.
Yeah. I think that is a big question. We've only seen 3 episodes. There's 9 episodes. they're at least doing this sitcom conceit through Family Ties, Roseanne, Modern Family, The Office. Like, these are all things that they've referenced. But how much is that balance going to be the sitcom plot, and how much is it going to be some of the other stuff that we see, like the beekeeper, like the stop moment, like the helicopter, like all that sort of stuff. You know, there's some stuff in episode 3 that we'll talk about next week. Like, yeah, I'll be interested to see if people are willing to hang with it. I like this sort of steady creep in, but it will depend. We'll wait and see, you know.
Yeah, it'll depend. And also, you know, it's asking more of its audience than a typical Marvel movie does. I mean, there are, like, you know, mysteries in those movies, or objects that need saving or finding or whatever. And, you know, they set up pieces and then, you know, tell you later in the movie what where those pieces fit into everything. But
yeah.
There's also action scenes kind of keeping, you know, the sort of casual viewer engaged. And this, while stuff does happen, I mean, a lot of the first two episodes is just the sitcom hijinks. It's the talent show. It's the boss coming over for dinner, or the, you know, the sort of mistake of the phone call of, like, he thinks it's the boss's dinner and she thinks it's the anniversary. Like, a lot of these first two episodes is just that. And I'll be curious to see how that translates into, like, fan attention, and if it'll bring in different fans who aren't necessarily steeped in the movies. Maybe they've seen a couple, maybe they've seen none, but are curious about the kind of conceit of this show, because I do see a potential for it alienating some fans, but also sort of engaging people who maybe have been resistant to the standard Marvel movie format.
I completely agree. That's my hope too, that this is an entree for people into the Marvel world. But as you say, there might be some people who like their Marvel movies, you know, punchy, who might like, you know, lose patience. So we'll see. The last thing I want to say, just to your point about, like, sitcom plots, I think what is interesting is, like, I think the sitcom plots, there's a lot of, like, clever little cutesy references to, like, Marvel stuff in here, and, you know, we'll maybe Bresnahan and I will get a little bit more, like, Easter eggy and stuff like that. But I think the sitcom plots are also manufactured to give us hints about what's going on. Like, this idea of, like, the sitcom plot of, oh my gosh, I forgot my anniversary, or I forgot what this date is, also has this double edge of, like, they can't remember a lot about themselves, and that's creepy and weird. You know what I mean? Or this, like, we have to avoid the town figuring out that, you know, my husband is drunk at this talent show, is sort of like, it has to do with this, like, paranoia, avoid discovery sort of thing. That's a very Bewitched thing. Like, Bewitched has a lot of, like, parallels to sort of, I mean, you know, for better or for worse, sort of, like, racial integration of neighborhoods or persecution of some kind or whatever. Like, Bewitched was sort of actively engaging in that in its very white way. And so I think some of that sort of, like, persecution, paranoia stuff is baked into the sitcom plot that they choose. So it's like, it's acting on a couple different layers, but ultimately it is a percentage game, right? And so right now it's like, what, 95%, 5%, 95% sitcom, 5% mystery in the first episode, and then maybe it ramps up to, like, 15% in the second episode, and then, like, 20%, you know, you know. And so I think it'll continue to encroach, would be my guess, but I don't know. So.
Yeah. And speaking of that evolution, I really appreciate in the writing how, you know, aesthetically the Dick Van Dyke homage looks similar to the Bewitched one, but there are subtle sort of, like, advances in the way that characters interact with each other, what kind of characters are on screen. You know, we see a few people of color added in the 60s episodes, or the Bewitched episode. Mm-hmm. And just, like, a little bit more bodiness, you know, like some bedroom humor, you know, which would have been, I think, pretty unthinkable in the 50s. I mean, again, the Dick Van Dyke show was not in the 50s, but they're You know, like Leave It to Beaver would not really have jokes intimating anywhere near towards sex, you know.
Right. And she's wearing pants in the second one and a dress in the first one. And they like push the beds together and suddenly it's one bed. Like, I like that the borders of the episodes, like at the end of, it's really the beginning of episode two that the beds go together, but it should be the end of episode one because the end of episode two, they go into color. So it almost seems like we're transitioning to the next era of the family sitcom on the borders of these episodes, you know?
So, right. Yeah.
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 Excellent. Well, is there anything else you want to talk about in these episodes?
Well, I mentioned her briefly at the top as a joke, but like Catherine Hahn is so good in this.
So good.
As the nosy neighbor. And I love that her husband, you never see him. Like, he's this virtual character.
Ralph.
Yeah, just this like obnoxious man who she hates. You know, she's great. I would have to assume that an actor of her, you know, yes, her stature, but also her like ability is going to be put to some really interesting use as the series goes on. Which I'm really excited for. I'm really excited to see what Teyana Paris does. She's also another welcome presence in anything she's in. So, I haven't been so as curious about a show from just the first two episodes in a while. So I'm looking forward to see where it goes. And, you know, I think it'll be really be helpful to do this with you because, I am not always the keenest observer of the sort of tropes that I should be paying attention to and stuff like this. So I'm glad that you can coax me along.
And likewise, I'm not always the best at seeing like the bigger picture of where it all sits in the larger cultural narrative. So I appreciate talking to you, Richard. Aren't we a pair? Mm-hmm. All right.
Oh, Ralph.
Ralph. Viz. I love that Elizabeth Olsen is like doing this Mary Tyler Moore Rob sort of thing. It's great. So yeah, so that's it. I mean, there was a lot to talk about, you know, to talk about a ramp up to the show and also two episodes at once. Next week, I think we'll have a little bit more opportunity to get kind of granular on an episode. But that is it for us for now. We're going to go to our interview with Kevin Feige. And then after that, it will be Anthony Bresican's turn. and we will see you next week.
Hey, I'm Brian Stelter, host of Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. This week, with the help of Dan Adler and Olivia Nuzzi, we're going inside the media circus swirling around Donald Trump's criminal trial.
People want coverage of Donald Trump. There are sort of shades of 2015, 2016. I found it to be a total break from the reaction to a lot of Trump coverage in the last 2 years.
Join me, Brian Stelter, on Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Hello.
Joanna, that's such a professional microphone. I feel like I've got nothing here.
Yeah, but I'm also in a closet, so, you know, it all balances itself out. I've heard you say that, you know, though it wasn't originally the plan, that WandaVision is in some way the perfect show to launch this era of Marvel television. But I'm wondering what specific, I can think of reasons why, the masterclass in TV we get from it, etc. But I'm wondering, you know, what you think it is about this show.
Well, there are... you're absolutely right. There are specific story elements that will unfold over the course of the series that tie into the future. And we've already not been shy about saying Wanda will be joining Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness and Lizzie's in London now filming that. But you're absolutely right. It's Marvel Studios' first foray into long form sort of TV storytelling, being an homage and a love letter to the format of television, and something that could only be done as a weekly episodic storyline versus a movie stretched out over 6 hours. We're going to do that too with other series that I think is awesome. But our first one being something that could only be done on television does seem appropriate as our first entrance into that medium.
So you've got this also accompanying this. You've got this new series on Disney Plus, the Legends sort of mini episodes that act as a sort of previously on Wanda and Vision.
Exactly
kind of
right. Exactly. Right.
Whose idea was that in the first place, and what kind of freedom does that allow you to assume what your audience will know going into something?
Well, I don't remember exactly whose idea it was. the team at Disney Plus, the team at Disney Marketing, the team at Marvel Studios had that idea and wanted to put it together. It is exactly what you said. It is basically a previously on the MCU, but also a nice reminder, even for us. There's nothing I love more than a movie montage. I love it. I'm inspired. I'm a sucker for it. I'll watch any of it. And seeing it on our own projects, it just doesn't happen that much. Comic-Con occasionally, we'll kind of reel together that celebrates, I guess, the 10th anniversary and leading into Infinity War and Endgame. There's a little bit more of it. But showcasing all the little clips of particular characters like Legends is doing is very unique and fun even for us to go, oh, yeah, that moment was great when Vision picked up Wanda out of the train car as Sokovia was blowing up at the end of Age of Ultron. And seeing all those moments together really is doing two things. One, yes, somewhat setting the stage for a show to come, but also as a inspiration to go back and watch all the movies on MCU movies on Disney Plus. So it was a nice way of doing both and having just a little refresher attached to each of the shows. And we'll be doing those for all of the upcoming series.
In that Legends episode for Wanda, you know, we are reminded of her origin in the MCU with Baron Strucker. I'm wondering for you, you know, the origin was kept a little vague. And I'm wondering post Fox deal, your ability to even say the word mutant in the MCU, how does that change your approach to telling Wanda's story?
I mean, it's really just given us more toys in the storytelling toy box, right? And more potential for the future. And pretty much, you know, we've said for a while, anything X-Men is still farther out from what we've already announced. So it is all about the future as opposed to this show.
That makes sense to me. And then you mentioned also this idea of being able to tell an episodic story like this one versus a 6-hour movie that might be some of the other series. When I talked to you before about this idea of the filmic MCU being like television, you sort of push back on that. And you're like, no, it's more like how we tell comic book stories. And I'm wondering, what is the, you know, is telling a TV story closer to how we have traditionally digested comic book stories in terms of the, like, is each episode an issue? Should we be thinking about it that way?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a way to think about it. We've often thought about the movies as a run of comics as opposed to an issue of comics. I guess just by the nature of the shorter run times and the multiple episodes, you could look at it as issue by issue. You know, I've always said the experience of reading comics is not that different from watching a cinematic storyline unfold. You're going through storyboards, you're turning the pages, the pacing, when it's well done, can be really exciting as you go from a little panel with one word on it and then turn the page and you got a splash panel across two pages, right? That rhythm is not dissimilar from editing into big moments on movies, or something that's so exciting about TV and even the three episodes you've seen is having beginnings and ends every 30 minutes or so, to have an interesting in, to have an exciting out. All that's, you know, all inspired by filmmaking rhythms, which also happen to track comic rhythms.
You know, one of the byproducts of watching this show is, you know, as you mentioned, you want to go back and you want to watch earlier Wanda appear and Vision appearances, now available on Disney Plus. But for me, I was most inspired to go back and rewatch A Knight's Tale, which is how I first fell in love with Paul Bettany, of this like great comic performance. And he's played it straight so often in his career since then, but he is this like great comedic force in the show. It like brought me so much joy to remember that. When did you realize that he was sort of the modern Dick Van Dyke that we needed right now?
Well, it's we knew right from the start that he and Lizzie are spectacular actors that we had only scratched the surface of. You go back and look at the scene between them in Civil War, where Vision awkwardly walks through the wall and they say, Liz, we talked about this, use the door. He's great. He's great. He's funny. He's vulnerable. He's a super strong android. And he totally pulls that off. So it was with great confidence that we knew we could go to these other places and these other eras and these other styles, because these actors could meet that and exceed that challenge in a great way. And Lizzie, in particular, showcasing, neither of them are a laugh riot in the earlier movies,
right?
And putting them in sitcoms, we wouldn't have done if we didn't think they could do it. They exceeded our expectations on how wonderfully they adapted to it. And authentically, I said in a conference, press conference earlier today, we did not want to make fun of old shows. We didn't want to laugh at, look how dated, look how silly these old shows were. We wanted to embrace the emotional connection that viewers had with them over the years. And we, as the storytellers, had with them, and Lizzie and Paul. That's a fine line to do something that's funny and silly and authentic, and they're spectacular.
One of my favorite things I've heard you say is that, you know, this show gets to justify all the time you spent watching Nick at Night. And it's the same for me. My Dick Van Dyke Show scholarship finally like gets to be aired out for the public. Thank you for that gift. When you're fleshing out the cast of people like Randall Park and Kat Dennings, and you've talked about these are actors who have experience with sitcoms and also happen to be in the MCU stable. So now I'm just envisioning that, you know, at MCU headquarters, at Marvel headquarters, you have this web, a wall of all these characters that you've previously established. And when you're cooking up new projects, you can just go to that wall. It's probably not a physical wall, and pluck sort of options that you have. And you're like, we've got Kat and we've got Randall. Let's figure out a way to sort of engineer them into the story.
Sometimes they are physical walls.
Okay.
on Infinity War and Endgame, we had cards, basically what looked like trading cards, slightly bigger, printed up of every character that appeared in any movie. And they were up on the board. And Joe and Anth and Chris and Steve and Trin and I would sit there and look and pull from it. What about this? We could do this. And in the case of WandaVision, as many writers' rooms have, the storyline of each episode would be up on cards on each of the walls. But in this case, they would be accompanied by the inspiration, the sitcom in the era's inspiration photos, printout. So it was quite fun to see that. And it really is, as the storyline was coming together, and Jack and Mary Lovanos, our executive producer, were in that room, you know, 24/7, coming up with the episode breakdowns and the overarching narrative of what WandaVision became. There were just opportunities. We needed a character like this. We wanted a scientist, or we needed a federal officer. We needed this. And because we have so many amazing cast members over the years, it would be like, well, this could be Jimmy Woo. Do you think Randall Park would want to come back and do it? Or, well, you know who has insight into this kind of technology theoretically over the years? Darcy Lewis. Kat would be amazing. And it is, you know, a great privilege that they agreed to come in and do it and continue to play in our sandbox.
So my last question for you is, or maybe my last, depending on how long it takes you to answer, is, you know, we're aware of the sitcom influences. There's also some early sort of filmic influences that, you know, you could pull out, Stepford Wise or Pleasantville, et cetera. But is there anything unexpected that audiences might not be looking for that you were keeping in your mind that influenced WandaVision?
Well, Matt and Jack at the press conference this morning talked about Twilight Zone, which was a big inspiration for twists and turns and stylistic. Anything else, of which there are a few, would be spoilers for what's to come. But it was always how to do that dance between what people have come to expect from the MCU and that level of that style of storytelling, that widescreen cinematic style of storytelling, contrasted with and woven within the sitcom aesthetics. And some of my favorite things that Matt did in the show, and you can even, some people will see it, I think some people will feel it, are the aspect ratio changes.
Yeah.
That I don't know anybody will care or notice, but I think it is so cool. And really, whether you recognize or not, you can feel that shift You can feel things shifting, even if you're not sure why. And somebody can pause and go, no, look, the aspect ratio changed. Or maybe everybody can tell. I don't know. But I'm excited about that.
I'm going to squeak one more in and ask you then, you know, I don't know that you might have imagined when you were making Iron Man that, you know, audiences would be ready for something as weird as this. A lot of people mentioned Guardians as sort of the moment that the MCU really knew audiences could hang with them through raccoons and trees, et cetera. But is there anything non-MCU related that people have been watching over the years that made you know that TV audiences were ready for something sort of as that go along for the ride with something kind of as off-kilter as WandaVision?
Well, I think almost any and every great peak TV or whatever you want to refer to it, premium, premiere, whatever the new age of TV is, it gives that example. I can't think of anything right now, but Game of Thrones and Stranger Things and Russian Doll. I mean, name your great show that hooked you. You have to figure out what's going on. You have to have the patience to allow the world to be revealed to you. And that's what a lot of great, really the TV that drives you. I'm very excited, even by this early feedback we've gotten on the three episodes, that people, some people like us respond to the Dick Van Dyke Show and to that technique. A lot of, almost everybody's responding to the mystery and what's happening. What does it mean? And where's it going? That's what hooks me in great television. So we were very confident that audiences watching programs week to week expect that now and are okay with that now. And the big turns, even episode stylistic turns, episode to episode.
Well, thank you so much, Kevin. I really appreciate it.
All right. Brenna, thank you.
All right. Bye.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's five policemen outside and two policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
All right. Welcome to our final act, if you will, of this still watching episode covering episodes 1 and 2 of WandaVision. I'm joined now by my other fantastic colleague, Anthony Bresnikan. Hello, Anthony.
Hello. Here for the final act of the show.
The curtain's coming down on us.
In the third reel, that's where everything is resolved. Although I don't think we're not going to get that with these first two episodes. Resolution.
So let me just sort of lay out the groundwork for what this section will be going forward. We're not talking spoilers, you know, like Anthony and I don't know, Anthony, if you've had a chance to watch episode 3, but I've seen episode 3. We're not going to talk about future episodes. We're not going to talk about things, you know, that were spoiled from like set photos or anything like that. But what is fair game in this section, as far as I'm concerned, is comic book material and... Mm-hmm. Observations from trailer footage, I think, is also allowed. That's my rule. What do you think?
Yeah, I think, look, it's clear that WandaVision is designed to be a mystery. It's meant to make you laugh. It's meant to satirize in some ways retro sitcoms. And it's made to make you go, what is going on here?
Right.
And it's a question the characters themselves are asking. So we're going to try to answer that within the context of this. But we have no foreknowledge of what's to come. So what we are guessing is just guesswork. We're not going to try to ruin it for you. So, you know, if we say, hey, we think this is what's going on, it's not – we might be wrong, right?
I am often wrong, as everyone listening to this knows. So let's start. So, you know, this is fair warning to everyone. If you consider comic book knowledge source material knowledge to be a spoiler, you might want to peace out and just call it a day. I will say Marvel has never, to my knowledge, Marvel Studios under Kevin Feige has never, to my knowledge, directly adapted a comic book storyline. There's always some sort of twist or character swapping or something going on. So even if you know all the comics by heart, even if you know Civil War and everything that happens in it, you're still going to go into Captain America Civil War not exactly knowing what's going to turn out because it's going to be different.
I feel like they take ideas and relationships and they grow a new story around that.
So all that being said, I actually just want to dive in from the start and talk about the big book that a lot of people think is the inspiration for what's happening here in WandaVision. And that is House of M.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the Brian Michael Bendis joint, and
from long ago too, from 2005.
Yeah, and there's some evidence, or you know, not just pure speculation. There's some evidence around this. Like, first of all, let's say Elizabeth Olsen gave a long ago interview when Age of Ultron came out. She said that Joss Whedon had given her like a WandaVision comics that made her understand that Wanda was like the most powerful person in the world. And that's what got her really excited to play the role. She never said what the comic was, but like, that sounds like House of M to me.
And well, I might have a little extra insight here. So, but go forward. I might have a little clue because I did an interview with her on the set of Age of Ultron and she talked specifically about the House of M. So,
never mind. Resolve.
Do we have a little bell to ring for when we resolve a mystery?
Yeah, a little like Bewitched twinkle. All right, resolved. It's House of M. She's never, except when talking to Anthony Breskin, said that it's House of M. But she said in a recent interview that like this is the payoff for those books that Joss Whedon gave her. And then the last thing I'll say before I'm going to kick to you and ask you to sort of like summarize House of M for people who maybe haven't read it, is there's a little Easter egg in the first episode when Wanda and Vision are hosting, the boss and his wife for dinner, and Wanda's pouring wine sort of magically out of a wine bottle. The label reads, Maison du Mépris, which means House of Contempt or House of Misery, House of M. So it's a House of M wine bottle in the first episode. So we think that that is a loose, inspiration for what we see here. So Anthony Breskin, do you want to tell listeners or remind listeners what the House of M storyline is?
Yeah, so the House of M, House of M is for House, they call it the House of Magnus in the story, but it's also House of Magneto because Wanda Maximoff and her brother Pietro, who's Quicksilver, are the children of Magneto in the comic books. Now, that's never been the case in the movies because of the mystical, magical world of character licensing and X-Men, which was held by the our friends at News Corp and the Fox family, the 20th Century Fox people. You know, they made all the X-Men films and they owned everything mutant. House of M could also stand for mutant, and the good folks at Marvel Studios could not use things that were Marvel Comics characters that had been licensed elsewhere. So those were off limits. So they could never, you might know better. You might even know directly about this. I don't think they were even allowed to use the word mutant.
They couldn't
at all.
They couldn't use the word mutant. Folks who have already listened to my interview with Kevin Feige, I asked him a little bit about this, if it was like easier to tell Wanda's backstory. Cause there's some trailer footage that looks like we're going to return to like Wanda's origins with Baron von Strucker, and I was like, is it easy to tell her backstory now that you can use the word mutant? And he said, we're forward looking with the concept of mutant. We're not going backwards with mutants.
Yeah.
So I don't, even though they can say mutant now, which may be why like Joss was like, love House of M, can't do it because of all the mutants that are in it. But maybe this is the first payoff of that Fox deal, Disney absorbing Fox. And now they can do, I mean, I'm not saying there's going to be mutants in this, story, though there might be, but like maybe even House of M they couldn't touch because it's like a, you know, it's complicated. No longer that, complicated.
Now, and you know, the fact that they have different versions of Quicksilver in both the X-Men movies played by Evan Peters.
Yeah.
Right? Remind me, who was the guy who
Aaron Taylor Johnson.
Aaron Taylor Johnson. So you had the same character turning up in different movies. There was no Scarlet Witch, no Wanda in the X-Men films, but
there was a little girl. I think it was a little girl who was.
Oh,
Wanda.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Thank you for reminding me. But Joss Whedon and the Age of Ultron people couldn't. They could use the characters because they technically existed in both licenses, right? It's just they had to be separate characters, and so we're gonna see. I think a little more background into who they are. And the reason that they devised in the original movies, in the Joss Whedon Age of Ultron film, is the reason these twins have superpowers is they were experimented upon by, is it Baron Strucker?
Yeah.
Is he? I don't want to make sure I get his title right.
Yeah, he's a Baron.
he didn't spend all those years in Baron school to be called Mr. Strucker. But he... you know, that he was experimenting on them with Loki's staff, which we, of course, later learn contains the Mind Stone, which is used by Tony Stark to create the Vision.
I know. I've always thought of them as, like, kind of soulmates, like, little, like, it's like having two halves of a best friend necklace, you know what I mean? Like, yes. Wanda and Vision are both created by the Mind Stone.
Exactly. And that is deliberately, like, I've heard from Kevin Feige himself, that's the reason she has such a strong connection to Vision is because she's connected to the Mind Stone. They share this link.
I love that.
So, you know, and the Mind Stone, of course, it affects your perception. Sure, you know, it's always a little foggy on what the Reality Stone does versus what the Mind Stone does. You know, there's a little bit of crossover in terms of territory and jurisdiction there. Okay, so there's a little bit. I think you need a little background on the movies in order to fully understand House of M. So House of M comes out like in 2005. And what it does is resets the Marvel universe. It kills off some Avengers. Wanda Maximoff she's sort of the MacGuffin of the story, I would say. Wouldn't you agree, Joanna? She's not the main character. She's the inciting incident.
Yeah.
But so much of the story, which expands to touch Spider-Man and all of these other properties. Like, to read the full House of M, it's like something like 20-some comics. Only eight of them are, like, called House of M.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah, because it spills out into the rest of the... Okay,
It spills up. So what happens is she has lost her mind. She has gone insane. And she is manifesting different realities and pulling people into them. And the X-Men and the Avengers get together, led by Charles Xavier, and they have to decide whether to destroy her or not. I mean, that destroy is the polite word, to execute her, because she is a living, breathing nuclear bomb, so to speak. Like, she can annihilate the world. She can change the reality. She is an unstable element who could destroy everything, reality as we know it, right? So the debate is, do we risk trying to save her life or preserve her life, or do we destroy her in order to protect the rest of the world? And, like, various heroes have different opinions about this. Like, Spider-Man is like, oh, so if my powers go crazy, you guys are just going to take me out? And, like, Wolverine goes, yes. And Wolverine says, like, say, I would expect you to do the same for me, right?
Yeah.
So it's one of those, like, things that Marvel Comics loves to do, which is to set up a point of debate that has validity on both sides. Mm. And so Wolverine, I think it's fair to say Wolverine is like the central character in the main spine of the yeah. House of M stories.
Wolverine, you know, and then like Emma Frost, I think, would be like the B player. Yeah.
Wolverine is so he like wakes up in this alternative reality where mutants are the dominant species and humans are subjugated by them. And he has to try to persuade everybody that this is not reality, and we have to switch back. And so that's how the story plays out. I don't think we should go too deep into like the outcome, because I think that's just the setup. The setup, in short, is Wanda has lost it. The Scarlet Witch has gone insane.
I'm going to push back a little bit on the whole, like, she's lost her mind, because I have, spoiler alert, I have talked to Elizabeth Olsen, not spoiler, but I've talked to her, we'll have an interview with her going forward. I think there's been some pushback on some of the depictions of Scarlet Witch over the years in terms of this idea of, like, presenting her as this, like, hysterical woman. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
And Elizabeth Olsen was very mindful that, like, that not be the case here in WandaVision. And
we're not talking about real people with mental illness here. Like, I want to make that clear, too. Like, look, we're talking about fantasy.
But I think what's true is that she's grieving. Vision has died.
Yes.
She killed him because she's lost control of her powers. Her children... she has these twins with Vision in another comic, and her children have been revealed to her to have just been like figments, like pieces of energy that she borrowed and got reabsorbed into this character of Mephisto, which we will talk about. And so she's lost her children and she's lost like her husband. And so she's grieving and unable to cope. And her coping mechanism is, you know, it's a little more complicated than that, but her coping mechanism is to create an alternative reality that is happier for her and happier for everyone. It's not a vindictive alternative reality. She tries to give everyone what they want, but it's not real. And so if you think about that storyline and you think about what we've seen in WandaVision, and we know that when last we saw Wanda, she was grieving the loss of vision. You know, I think it's, I'm not sure it's exactly this, but I think a reasonable guess might be that this sitcom world that she's zipping around in is some sort of alternative reality that she has created to cope with her grief.
Well, or the very least that she is generating, whether she intentionally creates it or not,
right,
is part of the question, because
absolutely.
The voice through the radio is like, who's doing this to you?
Right.
And you know, And yeah, I don't mean to make it sound like she's completely hysterical, but she's volatile. She's
absolutely unstable.
She's unstable. And the way, so here's where I want to drop what Elizabeth Olsen told me way back in the year 2014, which is talk about a different reality, right? Like imagine like you're in the year 2014 and like you step through a portal just to get a glimpse of 2021 and you're like, wait, what?
You're like, yikes.
Why is everybody wearing masks and game show? A reality TV host is being, you know, impeached for a second time. So anyway, she tells me my favorite of the comics is The House of M, because it gives you an end place for the character. So this is her at the beginning of playing Scarlet Witch. She goes, the Scarlet Witch just goes completely bonkers. So now she uses a different terminology, but that was what she said at the time. That entire series to me is fun, she says, because you get to see the highest and the lowest points of her strength. You see the potential of a character regardless of whether it has anything to do with what we're actually making in Age of Ultron. So she's playing, you know, Wanda at the beginning of her powers, but she's keeping in mind this is somebody who has tremendous abilities to manifest good and potentially be very destructive. And she can make something that exists larger than life. That was my favorite because it's so extreme. And she said she loves seeing, you know, all the ways these different characters can shape the whole world. So there's been a lot of debate about who's the most powerful Avenger, and I think she would probably have agreed that Wanda is.
Absolutely Wanda. Like, and I actually think that's been a problem. Like, Joss puts Vision and Wanda into Ultron. And ever since, I feel like the MCU has been like, what do we do with these mega overpowered individuals? If you watch those movies, the movies that they appear in, which is just Civil War, Infinity War, and Endgame, they have to go to great lengths to sort of like, put those characters on the sideline because they're way too powerful. You know what I mean? And so like the inciting incident of Civil War is Wanda losing control of her powers. And so she's afraid to use her powers. And at one point she incapacitates Vision so he can't use his powers. And then in Infinity War, it's all about like, you know, Vision being caught by surprise and compromised. And, you know, so it's like they can't play in the same pool as Captain America, however like impressive you may be, because Wanda can make you see stuff that's not there, you know? And so I just think it's been actually kind of an interesting thought problem for Marvel this whole time of like, how do we keep these incredibly overpowered individuals fighting side by side with our on the ground heroes, you know?
And that leads me to something I want to say about WandaVision and this trope of using retro TV as its I don't know what you would say, like as its platform, as its way of presenting itself. That you have, I'm not throwing shade at any particular show, and I think the Dick Van Dyke Show, which is the inspiration for the first episode of WandaVision, is brilliant television and was cutting edge in its time. But it was cutting edge because it established a language of sitcoms. It turned what would traditionally be a play into a TV show. And since then, that formula has been repeated over and over and over and over and over and over and over again, to the point where all of the innovation gets kind of beveled off or lost in the static. And I think what WandaVision does is it shows us somebody who's lost in this haze of something that isn't really all that sharp or even all that funny, but just more benign and light. Like, these sitcoms tend to be light rather than really, like, hilarious.
Right.
Because there's no discomfort in them. You think of the funniest things you've ever seen, and there's a little bit of, like, weirdness or awkwardness or pain in them. And sitcoms are all about just sort of, they're just the Advil you take to blunt the pain of existence. And so she's in this sort of halcyon, experience living, brought to you by Advil, by the way, our podcast, name drop some specific products. I feel like she's living in this sort of numb existence, and it's taking the shape of sitcoms. And that's how there's clearly some ugliness or pain below the surface,
right,
that is being blunted. And she's finding things like this strange little toy helicopter in the bushes that has a symbol. Do you want to talk about the symbol?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Let's talk about it. So it starts with, I think the first sighting we see is the very end of episode one. The credits roll in this sort of I Love Lucy kind of way on Wanda and Vish. And then we like pull out and we see that they're being monitored, or this thing is being monitored, and we see a logo. And the logo, it belongs to an agency called S.W.O.R.D. And if you recall S.H.I.E.L.D., S.H.I.E.L.D. has fallen. Now we moved on to S.W.O.R.D. Just this week, Breskin, did you see that just this week they've announced that S.W.O.R.D. in the MCU means something different than it does in the comics. And it's just a slight tweak, but it's interesting. So S.W.O.R.D. in the comics is Sentient World Observation and Response Department, which sort of feels, it just feels like a S.H.I.E.L.D., but make it galactic, right? In the MCU, it stands for Sentient Weapon Observation Response Division. I think that's interesting because what is Wanda if not a sentient weapon, right? And
for sure,
it seems as though S.W.O.R.D. is observing her, right? So we see some sort of observation station watching Wanda. We see the logo on the little helicopter, and then we see it on the back of that weird beekeeper that shows up in episode two.
And you know, in addition to all the 60s sitcoms that we're starting with on this show, I feel there's a real homage to Lost, which I know you're a big fan of.
Oh,
expert on.
Sure.
Is you have things like, you remember, like, what's the polar bear mean? What's
the smoke monster?
And, like, you know, it's like, what's the beekeeper? Like, the mysterious beekeeper who crawls out of a sewer. Like, I think things like this are just meant to make us go, what? Okay, like, it's meant to be destabilizing. And there's also a little bit of the usual suspects in this show.
Oh, how so?
You know, well, you know, again, I guess spoiler for like a 20-some-year-old movie, but like the end of The Usual Suspects is so famous because like Verbal Kint leaves the police department and the detectives realize all the names that he's been using are sort of taken from like the coffee mug and things he sees on the bulletin board behind him. And I feel like you know, the little commercials that are the interstitials, the sort of chapter breaks in each episode, those are meant to lead us to see what's going on here. Like, I think by the end of WandaVision, we're going to have that moment that the detective has where it flashes to this, it flashes to that, and you're going to see how all of these things piece together and what they actually mean. So it's just a little theory of mine. But I think we'll see it hold up. But of course, that also leads me to doing things like in the second episode, trying to scan the background and like the billboard in the background of their magic show.
Oh, I did that too. Yeah.
And the name of the, because we're looking at like the name on the wine bottle, right? And
yeah.
I think there's a clue there. But like, is there a clue in Wentworth's, the name of the department store? Or is that just a 60s sounding?
I also rewound to make sure that I wrote down Wentworth's. Can I tell you a theory that our producer Dave put forward to me that I really, really like? So the beekeeper and the helicopter. His theory is, like, Wanda has created a space for herself that is her reality, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it may be. And if something enters that reality, she has to reinterpret it in a way that makes sense to her reality.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea of the toy helicopter is like maybe there was an actual sword helicopter trying to enter her reality and it crashes and she interprets it as a toy helicopter. Or maybe the guy who's a beekeeper was actually like in a hazmat suit, but she had to interpret it in a way that she could understand so it looks like a beekeeper to her. I love that idea.
I think it's 100% legitimate. I think it's what human beings do when we dream. How often have, like, you had an alarm going off to wake you up, and in the dream it's like a telephone is ringing, and you can't pick up the handset because you can't stop the phone from ringing.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And it's like our brains do that. And it's also, to actually venture into the realm of real mental illness, you know, it's what our brains do when we're suffering from depression or anxiety. We take things that objectively should not make us fixate the way they do, like with obsessive compulsive disorder. We take things like it should be fine to touch that doorknob. It should be fine to not obsess about a particular fear or incident, and yet we do. Our brains just sort of grind away on that. And we try to and what's really happening is there's a malfunction in the way that you're feeling, and you're trying, your brain is trying to rationalize why you feel so bad.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
It's an imbalance of neurotransmitters, but your brain is trying to explain why you feel this way.
Yeah.
And I think maybe that was in the writer's minds, maybe that's not, but I think it's a thing human beings do, is they try to make sense of the world. It's what we're doing with this show. Like, we're seeing all these random little things and we're trying to piece it together. Like, we try to see shapes in the stars. We try to see faces in the wallpaper. You know, it's, I think there's a specific, like, scientific term for that. But I think what we have here is a character who's very powerful, but she can't change the trauma that she really experienced.
Yeah.
She can't bring back the things she's lost. And so she's manifesting a whole other way.
Right.
Thinking.
And in House of M, you know, she brings Hawkeye, who she also killed. She killed Vision, but she killed Hawkeye. She brings Hawkeye back to life. And so this idea that, like, she's brought Vision back to life, but he's not real. He's like mm-hmm. something she's created. And there's also these characters, this character in House of M, this little girl mutant who can wake other people up that she's also created. And that's one of the most interesting things about House of M is like Wanda's created this alternate reality. She's tried to create one that will make other people happy so that she is not hurting anyone while pursuing her own happiness, right? Her own escape from trauma. But there's a part of her that has a conscience of some sort, and she creates this little girl who can wake people up in this reality. And that's, it's almost like her saving herself from herself by creating that little girl. And so I think you see moments like that in these first two episodes, or specifically in the first one, when she, you know, this man is choking, the boss who's over for dinner is choking, and you've got his wife being like, stop it, looking at Wanda. And Wanda, it seems to me, directs Vision to, you know, it's a moment where Wanda has to acknowledge that she has control over this world mm-hmm. for a split second and do the right thing, you know?
I also think there's an element of like, you know, like the damaged nuclear reactors at Fukushima, like people have to go into those to try to manage the leaking of the nuclear material and to try to clean up, you know, and you can only go in for so long and you've got to obviously wear like protective gear. But you're putting yourself at risk venturing into this dangerous environment. And we have, the character played by Tiana Paris,
yeah,
who we know plays Monica Rambeau, but she is
Geraldine,
identifying herself as Geraldine.
Yeah,
but she even says something to Wanda like, "Why am I here? Like, what are we doing here?" And I feel like the beekeeper and maybe Monica, like they've gotten into this world,
right?
Or they're trying to approach this world that Wanda is in,
right?
And yet they're consumed by it, and they're absorbing, you know, let's say that radiation or that mysticism or whatever you want to call it, and it's distorting their maybe the beekeeper is able to be protected because he or she or whatever he is a, you know, we're not meant to recognize
the no, face but there is there someone right listed there. In the credits. Hold on, let me pull it up. I mean, it's not.
It's not, a stunt man.
It's not, yeah, it's a stunt guy. It's a Marvel stunt guy. It's not Randall Park or anything like that. So, like, I mean, the face may change, you know what I mean, once we see, like, who that really is. But for right now, it's not someone.
Zach Henry is. Yeah. And he's a stunt person and a stunt performer in a lot of different Marvel things.
Yeah.
But I feel like, you know, maybe Monica is, you know, she on a mission and she's.
Right.
And yet she's been bedazzled. I like the names, the show names that they come up with for themselves.
Oh, Glamour and Illusion.
As performance, Glamour and Illusion. Like, Illusion is Vision's.
That's a comic book. That's a comic book reference there's in Vision and the Scarlet Witch, I think the 85 run, there's a couple who are magicians who are actually like superpowered magic people who live in the same suburban neighborhood as Wanda and Vision, and their names are Glamour and Illusion. I thought that was a fun little moment. I've been doing
cool
my
point.
Homework, Anthony Breskin.
Very good. But also, I mean, just if you think about the significance of the names, an illusion is a fake thing. You're not really there, and glamour is a verb.
That verb, yes. Know,
you can
right
you
to
can
glamour
bedazzle
somebody. Yeah.
You can, you know, manipulate their minds, and so
that yeah. That brings me to my next thing that I want to talk about, which is the character that Catherine Hahn is playing. So her character's name in the show is Agnes, mm-hmm. and she's the like wacky sitcom neighbor. I do think that this is fair game to say that folks who know the comics very well have watched the trailers and noticed that Agnes wears a brooch that is very familiar to comic book readers. It is worn by Agatha Harkness, who is a witch character in the Scarlet Witch storylines. She is like, she was the Scarlet Witch's sort of mentor figure. She's an ancient witch. She's Scarlet Witch's mentor figure, but also her foe. And ultimately, like, things go very bad for them and stuff like that. It's ups and downs. But a lot of people have been wondering, like, you don't put Catherine Hahn, who is an incredible performer, you don't put her in, like, just the comic relief role. So what else is she going to be doing in here? And like, you know, Agnes is like Agatha Harkness, sort of allied and stuff like that.
Yep.
So a lot of people think that she, maybe in the same way that Monica Rambeau, like, there's a couple options. Is she the one creating this reality? Did she manipulate Wanda into creating this reality? Has she entered Wanda's reality and been bedazzled the way that Monica was? It all seems very possible, but I was rewatching episode one for like the third time right before we started recording, and I noticed that one of the first things she says is charmed. And so I just think, like, yep, looking out for, yes, those like magical words is a fun thing to do when you're watching the show.
I think this is a show that's gonna feel much different on the second watch.
Yeah.
All of those little things like charm. Yeah, exactly. You know, I think there are probably references built into the show that we couldn't even possibly perceive their significance until the end. And then we'll come back and see, like, oh, that's what lobsters meant, you know, something like that.
I mean, and like a fun thing that, yeah, so is Catherine Hahn playing the big bad of the season? Maybe a lot of comic fans think Mephisto, who is a big foe for Wanda, is the actual agitator. But if there is a Mephisto, we have no idea who might be playing him or her. My sense of how Marvel likes to tell stories, I feel like they wouldn't put a Mephisto in here. I feel like they would just keep Agatha Harkness in hiding in plain sight, and to the point where, like, maybe you think she's a victim of Wanda's glamour until you find out something more. This is pure hot speculation. I don't know what's going to happen, but that seems like an interesting story to me that they could tell.
I think you're onto something, and I think there's definitely more to Agnes than we know.
The other thing I want to say, I mean, you mentioned the commercials. Mm-hmm. The first one is, do you think the first one with the burnt toast, the toaster, forget your past, this is your future, Stark Industry toaster, do you think that's supposed to be a reference to, like, the ash on the toast? Like, I was trying to figure out, like, what it would be a symbol for, like, all the people who got ashed by Thanos, like, what are we talking about? Is Vision a toaster because he's an android? I don't know. Maybe I'm definitely overthinking these things.
It was the Toastmate 2000. Uh-huh. I was hoping it would be the Toastmate, like, 5000, because then it would be like, I love you 5000. Mm. But, like, it was just the Toastmate 2000.
Yeah.
And there's a couple that, like, I think they're the same performers in each one.
They are, yeah.
And then in the second episode, they're advertising a wristwatch, which is
Strucker.
By Strucker. Mm-hmm. And what is it, like, Strucker has time for you or something? Or would they have, like, a little catchphrase even that's a little ominous sounding? But I don't quite know.
It also says Hydra Made on the watch.
Oh yeah, Hydra Made. Yeah, yeah, exactly. That was very funny. But yeah, I kind of feel like maybe there's some, I mean, like, Vision was a Stark creation, so maybe that's what the toaster is. And also Tony Stark is toast. I don't know, like, what that could be. Maybe that's too on the nose. Toast.
The color, I'm trying to, I mean, like, we probably see the end of the color intrusion because we've now moved into the colorized world of WandaVision at the end of this episode too, but, like, the blood, the helicopter, and then the blinking light on the toaster was red. So I was trying to track all the color and see if I could come up with, like, a unifying theory.
And the toaster was also beeping in a way that made me think of a heartbeat or, like, a hospital room.
Yeah.
Where maybe somebody's being sedated and their pulse is being monitored, you know?
Yeah, and there's the ticking of the clock. Both of them felt very, those two commercials felt very, like, timekeepy. Tick, 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 you know, so.
You know, and, like, and, you know, so maybe Wanda has been sedated and this is her dream. And yet there are people like invading that dream, you know, trying to get through.
I think the question for folks who are already like, House of M, Sword, we're, you know. I think a question is whether or not we think Sword is a friend or a foe. And like, I think there are ways in which Sword is being positioned here at the beginning as ominous, like it's monitoring her, the logo's on the beekeeper, all this sort of stuff like that. But I have to say, if Monica Rambeau is an agent of Sword, I think that's a misdirection. And I think they're trying to help her. Randall Park, who plays Jimmy Woo, who's a former S.H.I.E.L.D. agent, FBI agent, who is in Ant-Man and the Wasp, is in this show and in the trailer. And I believe that's his voice coming over the radio in episode two. Wanda, who's doing this to you? Stuff like that. He's still an FBI. He's at least still wearing an FBI jacket in the trailer. So he's still an FBI agent. So I'm unclear if maybe the FBI is like coordinating with Sword or something like that. But to me, I would guess that like Sword is trying to help her, you know, or at least find a way to de-escalate that doesn't have to end with them terminating her in some way, you know?
I think you're right. That's my guess too.
That would be my guess, but I don't know. All right. Is there anything else in these first two episodes that we feel like?
I want to talk a little more about that. Just, I think hats off to the way they've cast it and the way they've created the sitcom world. It doesn't exactly match the style of shooting, you know, those old sitcoms like the Dick Van Dyke Show and Bewitched. But, you know, there's an actor named Asif Ali who turns up as like the neighborhood friend and coworker of Vision. And boy, his costumes and his haircut just calls to mind Maury Amsterdam Dick Van Dyke, like the style of it and the way, you know, even the nosy neighbor, you know, that motif and Fred Melamud as the oppressive, stuffy boss and Deborah Jo Rupp, who I think, you know, will be fun when she turns up in the 70s era episode, since we know her so much from that 70s show.
Yeah.
They've really cast it. They've really done a great job casting the types. And also shout out to Emma Caulfield, who played Anya on Buffy the Vampire Slayer. It was kind of neat to see her turn up again in this as Dottie, as the...
I love how you and Richard both said that in almost the exact same way. Emma Caulfield, who played Anya in Buffy Vampire Slayer. We love our Anya appreciation on this show, so I'm here for it. Yeah, I really loved her as this sort of like queen bee of the neighborhood vibe that she was giving off.
Do you think she has a more significance?
Only because
she got cut?
Because she got cut and she was like, she seemed to be, I can't remember exactly what she says when she gets cut. But it seemed to be another sort of like, I mean, honestly, I wouldn't be surprised if everyone other than Agnes is a Sword agent.
Yeah.
Trying to get like, to her, you know?
You know, it's like Poltergeist where they tie the rope around themselves and jump into the trans-dimensional closet. Like, I think like these are people I'm thinking who got lost, or who got trapped here.
Yeah.
You know, who came in, and we're going to find out that, like, okay, yeah, they all jumped down the well to save you, and then they stayed in the well.
Yeah, that's what it seems like to me. Mm-hmm. So we'll see. We'll see if that pans out. But I feel like we're going to see these neighbor characters that we keep seeing over and over again, or the hearts or whatever. Like, I feel like we're all going to see them in, like, a Sword office at some point. You know what I mean? So, once again, that's speculation, but that feels reasonable to me. I really like it. I think it's really clever. And what I like and why we structured this show this way is that it's really easy to enjoy this on multiple levels. You can enjoy it on the level that Richard's enjoying it, which is just like, you know, very much not knowing the stuff about House of M, trying to sort of figure it out for himself. And you can enjoy it on the way that we are, which is like, we might know all these things. We might be really wrong about a lot of stuff, but we might have like, think we figured out some of the premise. That doesn't make the show less enjoyable for me. It makes it more enjoyable. So, I really dig this show. I'm really happy we're watching it.
Me too. And I'm happy we're talking about it. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Is there anything else, you want to talk about before we go?
I think that covers it.
All right. So that does it for us. Anthony, until next week, where can folks find you?
You can find me writing away at vanityfair.com.
You can also find me at VanityFair.com and on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. You can find Richard at VanityFair.com and he's on Twitter at Rylaws. And we will see you next week in the 70s.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.